The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Ottoman Empire and the Renaissance of Spanish Jewry, is dedicated to the memory of Harav Yosef ben Avrom, Olav HaShalom, Rabbi George Vadnai of blessed memory, former chief rabbi of Lausanne, Switzerland.
One of the great tragedies of Jewish history was the decimation of Sephardic or Spanish Jewry. After living in the Iberian Peninsula for at least 1,400 years, in the wake of a series of persecutions which culminated in the expulsion of all practicing Jews from Spain in 1492 and the forced conversion of virtually all Jews in Portugal in 1497, Sephardic Jewry became a mere shadow of its former self. At the beginning of the 16th century, the vast majority of what was once Sephardic Jewry were now practicing Roman Catholics. The small minority who had survived the forced conversions, expulsions, plagues, and pirates were now compelled to rebuild life anew in strange distant lands on three different continents. In those dark days, it seemed the people who produced Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Rambam, the Ramban, and so many other great saints and scholars were doomed at best to mediocrity and at worst to disappear, assimilated amongst the local Jewish populations where they resettled. Yet during the 16th century, Spanish Jewry enjoyed its greatest revival, thoroughly taking over and absorbing the local Jewish populations wherever they went, and producing many of the world's greatest Torah giants. A list of the leading Sephardic, Talmudic, and Kabbalistic scholars of the 16th century probably takes up close to a half of the total list of such scholars that Spanish Jewry ever produced. It was in this century that the Shulchan Aruch was codified and the study of Kabbalah reached new unequaled heights, becoming accessible and understandable to generations of scholars. It seems that the suffering that those great people endured set the stage for such a great dramatic renaissance. The center of this renaissance was in lands controlled by the Ottoman Turks. The story of how the Turkish Empire became the new home of Spanish Jewry and the leading figures responsible for their revival is the subject of tonight's lecture. The Gemara Megillah in 13b, Yud Gimel Amud Beis, explains that whenever God wishes to punish the Jews, Bora Elohim Refuah Tchila, He carefully constructs the antidote, the medicine beforehand. It would seem that the refuah for the Spanish expulsion was the creation of the Ottoman Empire. In the first half of the 13th century, a small band of Muslim Turks were forced from their home in Iran by the Mongols and moved westward into Asia Minor. Under the leadership of their leader, Etogrul, they entered the service of Ala ad-Din, the Sultan of Iconium, the last remnant of the great empire that the Seljuk Turks had once created in Asia Minor. And just by the way, Asia Minor is the peninsula that juts out westerly on the western extremity of Asia. And if you look at your map, you know where Israel is, and you go north, you go to Lebanon, there's part of Syria, and then you get to Turkey. Because if you follow the coast, you move westerly. There's that peninsula which is called Asia Minor or Anatolia. It's bordered on the south by the Mediterranean, by the east by the Aegean Sea, which is part of the Mediterranean, and the north by the Black Sea. These Turks were granted some land in Phrygia, central Anatolia, or say Asia Minor. Othman, his son, this is Etogrul's son, and the namesake of the Ottoman Empire, from Othman, became leader of his tribe at his father's death in 1288, and expanded their original holdings through numerous conquests throughout Asia Minor. After Othman's death in 1326, his son, Orhan, carried on the aggressive policies of his father. He established his capital in Bursa, northeastern Anatolia, the ancient capital of Bithynia, having conquered and annexed it from the now crumbling Byzantine Empire. By the way, Bursa was the first Jewish community to come under the protection of the Ottoman Turks. In accordance with the peace treaty, the Greeks, or Byzantines of Bursa, were removed. In other words, in Byzantium, in the Byzantine Empire, Greek was the language. Greek Orthodoxy was the religion. The Jews, who were terribly mistreated by the Byzantines, were now granted freedom by their new conquerors. A special firman, a royal order, was decreed, allowing them to build a new synagogue, which they called Eitz Chaim. They were also allowed to engage in business in the country without hindrance and to purchase homes and land in the towns and villages. All of this was forbidden under the Byzantines. In addition, Orhan also captured Gallipoli, which from early times had a Jewish community. Gallipoli is a peninsula which juts out at the very eastern edge of Europe. There's a cross by the end of the if you go, you know, that which is the Aegean Sea, which is that part of the Mediterranean which is closest to the Black Sea. In between them, in the Aegean Sea, there's a strait, the Dardanelles. And the Dardanelles leads to the Sea of Marmara, which leads in turn to the Black Sea. In between where the Aegean Sea ends and the Dardanelles begins is this peninsula. This is Gallipoli. At last, it's about 50 miles long. So then this was, again, an early conquest of the Turks. His successor, Murad I, who ruled between 1360 and 1389, expanded the empire even further by capturing Adrianople in southeast Europe and making it his capital. So by now the Turks are already not only had a major foothold in Asia Minor, but were also now in Europe. He also expanded his holdings in Turkey and captured Ankara, which is today Turkey's capital. Both Ankara and Adrianople already had functioning Jewish communities. By the way, in 1389, Sultan Murad broke the power of the Kingdom of Serbia in the Battle of Kosovo. The Sultan lost his life in the battle, but his son and successor, Bayezid I, continued the fight and defeated the Serbs. Much of the political struggle in the Balkans today between the Muslims of Kosovo and Bosnia, these were the local residents who were converted by the Turks into Islam, and the Serbs, which were the unconverted Serbs, trace its origins to that battle. Let it not be said you didn't study some history here in this class. Bayezid went on to expand his holdings and conquer the cities of Sofia, Nicopolis, and Vidin in what is today Bulgaria. That whole area was once under Turkish domain. These towns also had indigenous Jewish communities. After Bayezid's death in 1402 at the hands of Tamerlane, the head of the Mongols, which is a story in to itself, a struggle ensued amongst his sons. Finally, in the year 1413, his younger son, Muhammad I, became the undisputed head of the Ottoman Turks and continued the conquests, capturing Izmir, or Smyrna, a city destined to become a major Jewish center. His successor, Murad II, who ruled from 1421 to 1451, extended his dominion over Macedonia and parts of Greece, capturing Salonika and Ioannina. Salonika, at the time, had an ancient community of Greek-speaking Jews called Romaniote, as well as recent refugees from Germany and Italy. So they all realized that those who settled in areas which were controlled by the Greeks, by the Byzantines, had a very difficult life. It was only after the Turks conquered them, in which they allowed complete religious freedom and freedom of commerce, that the Jews really began to thrive in these areas. To appreciate the difference of how Jews were treated in the Ottoman Empire compared to Christian Europe, we quote a letter, this first page, from a certain Yitzhak Tsarfati, to the Jews of Europe. It was really the Jews of the. It was addressed to the Jews who were in the communities on the River Rhine. To the holy communities of Germany who dwell in the cities by the Rhine River, I have heard of the affliction more bitter than death that have befallen our brethren in Germany, of the tyrannical laws, compulsory baptisms, and the banishments which are of daily occurrence. I am told that when they flee from one place, a yet harder fate befalls them in another. I hear an insolent people raising its voice in fury against a faithful remnant living among them. I see its hand uplifted to smite my brethren. On all sides I learn of anguish of soul and torment of body, of daily exactions levied by merciless oppressors. The clergy and the monks, false priests that they are, rise up against the unhappy people of God and say, quote, let us pursue them even unto destruction, that the name of Israel shall be no more among men, end quote. They imagine that their faith is in danger because the Jews in Jerusalem might peradventure buy the church of the sepulchre. For this reason they have made a law that every Jew found upon a Christian ship bound for the east shall be flung unto the sea. This, by the way, is a reference to an incident where Jews purchased land to build a synagogue on Har Zion, on Mount Zion, adjacent to a chapel owned by the Franciscan monks, the site of what is known today as King David's tomb. The monks complained bitterly to the Pope, evidently fearing that the Jews may take over the entire Holy Land, including the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The Pope immediately issued a papal bull forbidding Christian shipowners to convey Jewish emigrants to the Holy Land. I mean, you know, one has to realize, just putting this in perspective, there was only recently that the Pope, the Vatican, officially recognized the State of Israel. What? There's a question amongst historians, it's either the late 1400s or the 1500s. Alas, how evil are the people of God in Germany treated. How sadly is their strength departed. They are driven hither and thither. They're pursued even unto death. The sword of the oppressor ever hangs over their heads. They are flung into the devouring flames, into swift-flowing rivers, into foul swamps. Brothers and teachers, friends and acquaintances, I, Yitzhak Tsarfati, though I spring from French stock, yet I was born in Germany and sat there at the feet of my esteemed teachers. I proclaim to you that Turkey is a land where nothing is lacking, and where, if you will, all shall be well with you. The way to the Holy Land is open to you through Turkey. I mean, it would seem really from this thing that it really this is in the mid-1500s, where already Eretz Yisrael, the Holy Land, was under control of the Turks themselves. Is it not better for you to live under Muslims than under Christians? Here every man may dwell at peace under his own vine and fig tree. Here you are allowed to wear the most precious garments. In Christendom, on the contrary, you dare not even venture to clothe your children in red or in blue according to your taste without exposing them to the insult of being beaten black and blue or kicked red and green. And therefore are you condemned to go about plainly clad in sad-colored clothing. All your days are full of sorrow, even the Sabbaths, and the time is appointed for feasting on Yontif. Strangers enjoy your goods, and therefore what profit is the wealth of your rich men? They hoard it, but to their own sorrow, and in a day it is lost for them forever. There's no security in the Christian lands. You call your riches your own? Alas, they belong to them. They bring false accusations against you. They respect neither age nor wisdom. And though they give you a pledge sealed 60-fold, yet they would break it. They continually lay double punishment upon you, a death of torment and confiscation of goods. They prohibit teaching in your schools. They break in upon you during their hours of prayer, and they forbid you to work or conduct your business on Christian feast days. And now sing all these things, O Israel. Wherefore sleepest thou? Arise and leave this accursed land forever. Murad II's positive attitude towards the Jews was certainly enhanced by his employment of a Jew as his personal physician. Rishmul di Medina, or the Marashdam as he is more commonly known, one of the leading Torah authorities of the Ottoman Empire in the 16th century, describes a story of this physician in the following teshuva, a legal responsum which he wrote. And here's what we read on page 3. It's a fascinating story. There was an incident with a wise and honorable Jewish physician, as we know from other sources, his name was Jacob Pasha, who traveled from the land of his birth with the intention of coming to Eretz Yisrael. He came to the city of Andrianopolis, the then capital of the Ottoman Empire, and treated patients there. The king's ministers were very impressed with his medical skills and sang his praises to the Ottoman Empire, Sultan Murad II, who happened to be at the capital at that moment. Murad then took him and made him part of the royal household. While there, Jacob developed a very close relationship with the king's son, Muhammad II, who asked his father that Jacob become his own personal physician. To this, the king agreed, and from that time on, Jacob traveled together with the king's son and served him. In the year 1451, Muhammad II succeeded his father to the throne in his capital, Andrianopolis. And he continues on, it was during this time the king, wishing to elevate his physician, for he was taken by his wisdom and intellect, agreed to free the physician and all his posterity. This is really the subject of this legal response. Male and female, from any kind of taxes or levies for all eternity. It seems that the king initiated this out of his love for him without being prodded. In the year 1453, the king conquered the city of Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire, and made it his own capital. That really marked the end of the Byzantine Empire. And he continues on, the physician then took up residence together with the royal household in the new capital. The physician lived, though, in the Jewish section together with the Jews, who were there already at the time of the conquest, and the Jews who now took up residence, as there were new Jews who started coming in, having been forced to forsake their ancestral homes at the behest of the king. In other words, after the Turks conquered Constantinople, it wanted to make it a major commercial center, and he needed Jews. And therefore he forced the Jews who lived in all the outlying communities to move to Constantinople. So not only did you have the resident Jews who suffered terribly under the Byzantines, but all the other Jews were now prodded, it's not clear exactly what the prodding was, but they came in droves to Constantinople. So really it made it, through having the Jews, it really made it a major commercial center. And this physician lived now in the Jewish section of all the Jews who originally lived there and all the Jews who are now moving in. A little like Oak Park. You know. Not only the physician, but all his progeny continued to live in the city of Constantinople together with the descendants of the original residents and those who moved there subsequently. During this entire period, neither the physician nor his descendants contributed to any form of taxation that was paid to the Jewish community. This was based upon two separate written agreements that King Muhammad II had made on behalf of the physician. After Muhammad's death in 1481, his son, Sultan Bayazid II, took office. Again, the second, something they're not part of the responsa. He reconfirmed his father's agreement to exempt the physician's family from taxes and put it into writing. Afterwards, this is in 1512, he was succeeded by his son Selim I, who also reconfirmed the rights granted to the physician's family by his forefathers. He was succeeded in the year 1520 by the pious and benevolent, he's called a chosid in the responsa, Sultan Suleiman, who also reconfirmed those rights previously granted by his ancestors. Afterwards, in the year 1566, he was succeeded by our master, the mighty and magnificent, benevolent and upright, this is King Selim II, who also reconfirmed the exemption granted by the five previous kings. there was a petition sent by the Jewish community in Constantinople feeling it was not fair. They were a big family already. You know, and they should be all exempt, you know, not pay, why should it all, you know, be placed upon, you know, their shoulders? I mean, there are different taxes. There's a poll tax. That was individual tax. So if they're not taxed, that doesn't affect the other Jews. And because there was a certain price per person. But there were general taxes that the entire Jewish community had to pay. So they should take part in this. His response was, this is the Shmuel, this is the Medina, the Marashdam, in my opinion, we're required to observe the king's decrees, as that they are freed from taxes. And this is the Hatsoyer, he calls him, the young, the humble and inferior Shmuel de Medina. By the way, Suleiman, mentioned this responsa, is considered by historians to be the greatest of all of the Turkish kings or sultans. He is known in history as Suleiman the Magnificent. Although his father Selim had already wrested control of Syria, Israel, and Egypt between the years 1516 and 1517, after his death in 1520, the governors of Syria and Eretz Yisrael rose up in rebellion. Suleiman quickly crushed the rebellion, changing all of the governors of the region and replacing them with loyal Ottoman Turks. There is, by the way, a memorial that bears witness to his greatness. The walls around the old city of Jerusalem, which are still standing today, were constructed at the behest of Suleiman. So, it's a shame. You go to Eretz Yisrael, as you'll see the old city, those are Suleiman's walls. As was indicated in the responsum, the Tshuva Marashdam, after the death of Muhammad II, the conqueror of Constantinople, in 1481, his son Bayezid II became sultan. Like his father and grandfather before him, he too had a Jewish physician. His name was Rav Yosef Hamon, and he came from a family of physicians from the city of Granada, Spain. He served Bayezid II until his death in 1512, and also served his son and successor, Selim I. He exerted much influence in the royal court and supported yeshivas and scholars. By the way, Bayezid II was well disposed to the Jews, and is quoted as having said in reference to King Ferdinand of Spain's expulsion of the Jews, quote, "You are mistaken to call the king wise, for he only ruined his own country, you know, by expelling the Jews, and enriched our own." Rav Yosef's son, Rav Moshe Hamon, also a physician, followed in his footsteps and personally accompanied Selim I in 1516 in his conquest of Egypt. After Selim's death in 1520, Rav Moshe Hamon became Sultan Suleiman's personal physician, and even accompanied him in his military campaign against Persia in the year 1534. This is an aside. There's an amazing story that's related to that trip. He came, the campaign was against really Iraq and Persia. History repeats itself. And when he came to there was a city in Persia, Trebizid, he noticed there weren't Jews there, but he noticed that the Muslims, many of them, closed their stores on Shabbos, on Saturday. And he asked them why. And they didn't know. I guess that's what their parents did. And it seems they were the remnants of Jews who had been forcibly converted, you know, by the Shiites, who still retain some semblance of their Jewishness, similar, you know, to the Muranos in Spain, who even after they had forgotten, even that they were Jews, but retained some certain Jewish practices. You know, it's just interesting, again, there's another side, and this would be the subject of a lecture of a whole series. You know, in Afghanistan, you know, the Pathans, you know, which is a major tribe of the Afghanis, have a bris milah when the child is 13, which is the normal Muslim custom, but when the child is 8 days old. And there, this and for other, you know, other evidence, it seems that they also, at least partially, are descendants of Jews. So next time you speak about the Afghanis. In the year 1545, there was a blood libel charge against the Jews in Greece, and as a result, some Jews were killed by Greek Christians. Rav Moshe Hamon, using his influence with the Sultan, succeeded in having the murderers punished and having a royal firman, a royal order issued stating that future accusations of this sort be brought directly to the Sultan. The following is a story connected with Suleiman and his physician Moshe Hamon, written by Rav Yosef Sambari over 100 years after these events were said to have occurred. There seemed to be much, let's say, legend in this story. I haven't quoted the entire story, but it's a fascinating story. And this is, again, this is from Divrei Yosef. Yosef Sambari was a scholar who lived in Egypt, and he wrote this in the year 1672. In the days of the Sultan Suleiman, the famous minister of Moshe Hamon, of blessed memory, flourished. He dedicated his life for his people and stood in the king's court to defend the Jews against any enemy or accuser. In this capacity, he got the king to issue a declaration stating that any blood libel by which Christians accuse the Jews of killing a Christian and using their blood in matzahs cannot be brought before any minister or magistrate, but solely before the court of the king, as this would obviate any prejudice by the thing, and they would clearly see the facts. They say that he was a pious and benevolent king. It's called in the Chosid, because the prophet Eliyahu revealed himself to him, and he goes in great length about how Eliyahu Hanavi, I guess, and this would seem to be legendary, was a regular visitor, Elijah the prophet, of this Sultan Suleiman. The reason is because the king loved and cherished the Jews and brought them into his government. This aroused the jealousy of the vizier, like the Mishnah Lamelech, the second in command, an anti-Semite, who began to implement this plan to utterly destroy the Jews. He ordered workers to build a tunnel which would run from his house to below the king's bedroom in the royal palace. One midnight, shortly after completion of the tunnel, the vizier secreted himself in the tunnel below the royal bedroom and called out to the king in what sounded like a haunted voice, "Suleiman, Suleiman, arise and destroy the Jews." And imagine what would happen to you if you got such a message in the middle of the night. Suleiman summoned his physician Moshe Hamon, for Moshe was held in the highest esteem by the king and queen. And it goes on in great detail that Moshe Hamon went out of the city in the desert, and he met Eliyahu Hanavi, and through the intervention of Eliyahu Hanavi, the plot was uncovered, and the vizier was hanged at the entrance of his own house. But as a result of this legend goes on, that the Suleiman asked that Eliyahu be a constant visitor of his again. You know, this reminds me about, you know, it is legendary, but it reminds me, we've told this story before in the class, it's just such a beautiful story, and it probably applies in this situation as well. The Chofetz Chaim, you know, the famed scholar and saint who lived before, who died before the Second World War, was at one time called as a character witness. This was, I believe, the setting was the First World War, and there were students of his, or former students of his, who were accused of smuggling, was then a capital crime. And he was called in by the defense to be a character witness. So before he took the stand, the prosecutor asked about to know about the character of the character witness. I mean, you could imagine, if we had a mafia don giving, you know, bearing witness on the character of one of his underlings. I mean, sound wonderful. So what is the character of the character witness? So he told a story about the Chofetz Chaim. and he was once in Warsaw, and he was pickpocketed. And he ran after the pickpocket, knowing fully that he would never recover what was taken from him. And he ran after him and says, "I forgive you, I forgive you." In other words, that he shouldn't be punished, you know, because of the Chofetz Chaim. So the judge asked the defense attorney, "Do you really believe that story?" And the defense attorney replied, says, "Judge, Your Honor, frankly, I have my own doubts. But one thing is certain. These stories, they don't tell about you or I." So, by the way, the Hamon family served the Sultan as physicians for over 200 years. Rav Moshe was succeeded by his son, Rav Yosef, who in turn was succeeded by his son, Rav Yitzchak, who in turn was succeeded by his son, Rav Yehuda. He died in the year 1678, this Rav Yehuda. He in turn was succeeded by his son, Rav Aaron Hamon. As we quoted earlier, prior to the destruction of Spanish Jewry, Hashem prepared a haven for them, the Turkish Empire. In the period following the collapse of the Byzantine Empire and the ascent of the Ottoman Turks and the Jewish community in Constantinople, Hashem also prepared a gifted Gadol, a giant in Torah, who ably led that generation and was there for them to accept the newish Spanish exiles and facilitate their resettlement. His name was Rav Moshe Kapsali. This is what various historians write about him. The first account is from Yosef Sambari, which we quoted before, of Egypt, who wrote these words some 200 years after these events. In the first year of Muhammad II's reign, he proclaimed throughout the realm and put into the writing the following: "God has given me nearly all of the kingdoms on earth. All of the progeny of the Jews who dwell in my kingdom, listen to my pronouncement, and with the grant of total religious freedom, I ask of you the all move to the capital city, Constantinople. There in the choices of lands you will prosper and flourish." Jews from throughout the entire empire gathered there like the sand of the sea, and the king allocated for them land. There they firmly took root, multiplied and thrived. He gave them permission to build synagogues and study halls, and those Bote Medrash, and created three seats in the Divan, the Privy Council of the Ottoman Empire. One was for the Muslim Mufti, one was for the Greek Orthodox Patriarch, and the other was for the Chief Rabbi. There they equitably adjudicated the issues of their respective communities. The office of Chief Rabbi was filled by this elder Rav Moshe Kapsali of blessed memory. The king loved him dearly and placed his seat next to that of the Mufti. Rav Moshe was exceedingly humble. He would fast the entire year, sleep on the ground, led a very ascetic life, and toiled in the study of Torah. The king was very impressed with his good advice and subsequently placed him on the most exalted position above all of the other judges. The taxes which were placed upon the community, the Haraj, poll tax, Avariz, extraordinary tax in times of war, in Rab Akgeshi, the rabbinic tax, were levied and collected through the auspices of the chief rabbi and given over to the king's treasury. The king loved the entire Jewish community. At that time in Constantinople, there was a terrible, unparalleled outbreak of a plague. The king was confounded by the overwhelming number of plague victims, for the area had now become desolate and totally cut off because of the quarantine from the rest of the Muslim world. He summoned all of the non-Jewish scholars and asked for an explanation for this great display of God's anger. They were silent. He then sent for the chief rabbi of Moshe and asked him. He replied, based upon the Torah of Moshe, that plague comes from immorality. The king was pleased with the answer and proceeded to launch a major investigation into the matter. He discovered an enormous degree of licentiousness and subsequently put to death a great number of the Janissaries, this is his elite corps of troops, who were so involved. The chief rabbi as well rebuked his people and severely punished those members of the community who were involved in immoral pursuits together with the Janissaries. As a result, God had mercy over the land and the plague subsided. From that time on, the Janissaries' ire was raised against the chief rabbi, as they knew that he was the one who advised the king, and they attempted to assassinate him. The Holy One, however, saved him from their hands. When the king requested of the chief rabbi to provide him with a personal physician, the rabbi provided him with one, which was probably Rav Yosef Hamon. Moshe Kapsali's God servant, after living a full life, died at an old age. And according to historians, he was 76 and he died in 1496. As an aside, the Janissaries, this elite corps, played an important part in Turkish history. This elite infantry corps, the first standing army in all of Europe, was originally formed by the Sultan Orhan in the year 1330. It originally drew its ranks from war captives and Christian slaves who were forcibly converted to Islam. Eventually, its ranks were supplied by newly conquered Christian subjects who were forced to give up their own children to be raised as Muslims and specially trained to become members of this elite corps. They were called Yeniçeri, or new troops in Turkish, hence Janissaries. Led by a special leader, Aga, these troops were not allowed to marry or grow beards and lived in special barracks. During peacetime, they served as police. In wartime, they served on foot and were noted for their wild, impetuous attacks against the enemy. The bodyguard of the Sultan was recruited from their ranks. Although originally well-disciplined and completely subservient to the Sultan, in the middle of the 15th century, they began what became a long series of revolts. By the 17th century, the Janissaries had become completely corrupt and unreliable. They became such a threat to the Sultan that in the year 1825, Sultan Mahmud II ordered his subjects to attack the mutinous Janissaries. The Janissaries were defeated with a loss of 16,000 men. In 1826, the organization was officially dissolved and thousands more killed and over 20,000 banished. The story recorded here of events in the 15th century with the Janissaries would seem to mark the beginning of their corruption. The story dealing with their immorality, even though it is highly ambiguous, becomes more understandable in the light of the official prohibition for the Janissaries to marry. On page 6 in paragraph D, we discuss the special taxation system that was imposed upon the Jews. It is taken from one of the responsa of Shmuel de Medina, the Marash Dam. And just quickly, just to give you a sense of, again, the special taxes the Jews had to pay. When the king was firmly settled on his throne in the city of Constantinople, which he had conquered, he established laws governing all the various peoples living in the city as well as the Jews. He originally imposed upon the Jews a poll tax, the Bash Haraj, to be collected every year. The king created a ledger to record the names of all those who paid the tax. The second tax imposed upon the Jews was a general Jewish tax, a fixed amount he paid to be paid to the government that was divided amongst the individual Jews, each according to their ability. This was done under the auspices of the leaders of the community. The king was not aware of the individuals who paid this tax. This tax was called At Geshi, the rabbinic tax, for through the Jews were allowed to have a chief rabbi with recognized powers. By the way, this did not last very long, and even after the office of chief rabbi was disbanded, they still had to pay this tax. In addition, there was the Chavariz, extraordinary tax in times of war. One has to realize the Turks were constantly at war. Besides the influence he had in the royal court, Rav Moshe Kapsali was known as a saint, a tzaddik, and scholar. We quoted already from Yosef Sambari about the fact he slept on the ground, he was an ascetic. This is what a younger contemporary, Rav Binyamin Zeev, the Rav of Arta, the author of the work, this is Binyamin Zeev, writes of him in a letter which was directed to him. And he says, "The acclaimed, flawless Torah scholar, His Excellency, who excels in all areas of knowledge and science, the tree who bears fruit, the mighty oak, Rav Moshe Kapsali. Rav Moshe was the absolute Torah authority within the Turkish Empire. In the process, he acquired several enemies who tried to undermine his position. On page 7, we quote the following account from the report of Rav Kapsali's great-nephew, Rav Eliyahu Kapsali. It is an amazing story and speaks for itself. In Constantinople, four troublesome personalities were jealous of Rav Moshe Kapsali's position, for no contemporary of his was granted such power, and all the Jewish communities were subservient to him. Their hatred of him caused them to pervert their judgment, and they attributed to him things he never said or even thought. Acting with guile, they also produced false witnesses to support their claim. A certain Ashkenazic Rav by the name of Moshe 24, Zeshrim V'Arba, and he has his theory, he was named so, for he only had expertise in the 24 books of the Bible, and not in the Torah Sheba'al Peh, not in the Oral Law, not in the Talmud. Other scholars really disagree with this, and claim that the word 24 really refers to a section in Germany, which he came from. But he continues on, says that this Moshe, says 24, joined this group. At that time, he was an emissary who came to collect for the poor of Jerusalem and came to Constantinople to ask for their help. They did not heed his request because the Turkish government was presently in a state of war with Egypt, who then controlled the land of Israel. And the Rav, Rav Moshe Kapsali, was fearful that the Turkish Sultan may hear that he, Rav Moshe Kapsali, was the cause that monies left Turkey to support the economy of his enemy. You know, this was a particular problem when Jews in the Second World War wanted to send money to Europe, and the Jews in America to send money to Europe to help Jews who were under the Nazis, because how could they send money to the enemy? And he continues on, this is why they did not help him. They did not, however, hinder his efforts. When the communities, and this is outside Constantinople, saw that the Rav did not lend within Constantinople, did not lend a helping hand and support him, they paid no attention to his, Moshe 24's, pleas. As a result, he was unable to collect any funds. This Moshe 24 did not understand the Rav's true intentions. In addition, he forgot the help that Rav Kapsali had given him in his dealings with the esteemed Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, who once forced him from his synagogue and refused to let him address his congregation. Moshe 24 came to Rav Kapsali crying and complained bitterly about his public disgrace. The Rav, in his piety and compassion, had pity for him and spoke to him and intervened resolutely on his behalf. Despite all of this, he joined the group of Kapsali's enemies and carried with him documents that were prepared by them and went to the distant land of Italy, where they did not recognize the greatness of Rav Kapsali, and presented them to Rav Yosef Cologne, the Marik. Marik trusted their words without having heard Rav Kapsali's version and immediately wrote an unwarranted scathing criticism of him. And I quote just from part of this. He wrote several tshuvas, the Marik, as a criticism of what he had heard. These were the documents presented to him by this Moshe 24. And on that basis, he wrote this responsa. This is taken from one of them. I am taking up the cause, the honor of the Lord of hosts, and criticizing that man, Moshe Kapsali, who causes the community to sin, who desecrates the name of heaven through compromising the integrity of the public. I have seen documents written and signed by the distinguished members of the great community of Constantinople. And he continues, I hereby declare that he should cease and desist and repent from his evil ways and forbid that which he ruled to be allowed. He continues, if Moshe Kapsali refuses to listen to this declaration, may be excommunicated from the community of the diaspora and the entire Jewish community. And he continues, I also decree that no one should refer to Moshe Kapsali as Rav or Chover, for he is in no manner fit for such a title. Remove the turban and crown from his head, for he no longer be called a Rav or a Chacham. Velio Capsali continues on. And he writes, over 2 years, the letter sent by the Marik remained in Constantinople without being delivered to the Rav, until the Rav's brother, Reb David, this Reb David is the grandfather of Elio Kapsali, presented it to him. As soon as he received this letter, he arranged a meeting of all of the congregations in Constantinople. Now, because Constantinople had many different communities. I mean, there were the Spanish Jews, the Romaniote, in other words, the Greek-speaking Jews, from all those who had come from all... from all of the empire, and from abroad, of Italy, and to settle there, and read it before them. They were shocked and outraged and sought out those four individuals who falsified the original report. Each and every one of them, however, had already died during the interim, punishment being meted out to them in a providential plague. Moshe Kapsali wrote to the Marik at length, pointing out the logical difficulties of the subject matter. Displaying his great intellect, he pointed out all the various abstruse legal opinions on the subject and argued back and forth over the various points and said in writing to him. In addition, all of the great scholars of Constantinople wrote scathing letters to him. Even the venerable Torah scholar of Yehuda Mintz, supporter of Kapsali, wrote a stinging rebuke to the Marik. It began with the words, "Over whom have you lorded over? Against whom have you lifted up your tongue?" He praised Rav Moshe Kapsali, for he knew him from the time he was studying in the yeshivas of Germany. In addition, the greatest authorities in Germany, such as Rav Yaakov Margolis, took up the cause of God's honor by defending Rav Kapsali. When he received all of the above communications, the Marik became severely distraught. He realized that he had acted with impropriety. Filled with great remorse, he cursed the person who was the cause of all of this. Shortly afterwards, Marik became seriously ill and died. On his deathbed, he called his eldest son, Rav Peretz, to his side and made him swear he would travel to Constantinople to placate the Rav. He did just that, and the Rav, in his piety, received him warmly and even helped him as a means of honoring his father, the Marik, in his legal dispute with the esteemer of Eliyahu Mizrahi. In the year 1492, Rav Moshe Kapsali organized rescue efforts on behalf of the Jewish exiles. According to the description of Rav Eliyahu Kapsali, his great nephew, quote, "Then the communities of Turkey performed innumerable and unlimited great deeds of charity, giving money as if it were stones, to redeem captives and restore Jews to their environment." End quote. One of the most active persons involved in these efforts was Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi, who was mentioned before, who eventually succeeded Rav Moshe Kapsali as chief rabbi in the year 1496. Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi was one of the leading scholars of his time and authored a classic commentary on Rashi's commentary to the Torah, as well as a commentary to the Sefer Mitzvos HaGadol, a work written by the Baal Tosfos for Moshe Mikutzi in the middle of the 14th century. He also issued responsa which filled two volumes and also was responsible for spreading much Torah throughout Turkey. This is what Rav Yosef Sambari writes about him. This is on page 9. Afterwards, Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi became leader of Turkish Jewry. He also retained the powers vested to him by the throne, as he had a seat on the royal council and was the chief justice of the Jews. Due to his immense wisdom and intellect, he was also the king's advisor. And this is how Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi himself described his rescue efforts on behalf of the Spanish Jews. "All of those who were expelled from Spain received honor from me in accordance with my ability, and I performed many services for them as they themselves attest. For almost a year I toiled on their behalf to collect funds, many hundreds of florins, to free those that were taken captives. I became embroiled in a terrible controversy with all of the various Jewish communities as I gathered on behalf of the Jewish exile on three or four occasions close to 3,000 florins." And there's the many hundreds of florins he collected for Pidyon Shvuim, like to release captives. But there were resettlement costs on people who were not captives, who just came and were impoverished. In this process, I excommunicated many wealthy members of the community because they refused to contribute the amount that I had asked of them. I also used a considerable amount of my own resources, as God is my witness. I even put my own life in danger due to the immense and constant strain and aggravation that I went through day and night. This is in addition to the sacrifice of almost a year of lost study and research. Of his own personal difficulties, just as in what the person was, in the years before he assumed the position of chief rabbi, he writes here on page 10, many are the burdens and difficulties that come in succession one after the other. This is in the middle of a responsum. The difficulty of providing for a family and small children. My present occupation was providing a dowry for my daughter of sum of more than 600 florins. See, it's not a new thing. My involvement with the trials and tribulations of dealing with the members of the community. The responsibility of dealing with students, may the Almighty protect them, the majority of whom have been accepted as a result of pressure placed upon me by their relatives. This extends beyond the study of Talmud. I am forced to teach each student a particular subject that interests him. One of them wishes to study logic, another wishes to study fractions, another arithmetic. Every day the subjects change. The most difficult thing is that I am fragile by nature and cannot bear all of this suffering. There rarely goes by a month where I'm not completely overcome by fatigue for at least a day or two. In a past lecture, we studied the history of the Karoyim, the Karaites, the sect of Jews who denied the validity of the oral law and lived a life apart from mainstream Jewry. Rav Eliyahu Mizrachi was very much in favor of reaching out towards them and having them, this is, return back into the fold. This is what he writes on page 11. This is again taken from a response in a tshuva. Those who teach the Karoyim, the Karaites, are attempting to bring them under the wings of the Divine Presence. There is no greater mitzvah. Those Karaites who are not the original heretics who deny the validity of the oral... These Karaites are not the original heretics who denied the validity of the oral law, but their distant descendants. Close to 1,000 years have elapsed from the beginning of the movement. These descendants are akin to children who were kidnapped and raised by Gentiles whose memory of true Judaism has been completely submerged. These sentiments can equally be applied today to a large segment of our community. The constant conquest of the Ottoman Sultan resulted in mass relocations for the Jews. This, in addition to the influx of Spanish Jews, caused major changes in Jewish life. On page 12, we quote a responsum from the Maharaj Dam regarding one of these discussions. I'll just summarize this. As a result of the conquest of Hungary, the Jews in Hungary were displaced. And they moved to Sofia, which is today the capital of Bulgaria. Sofia already had a large Jewish community. There were Ashkenazim from Germany, Romani, the Greek-speaking Jews, Sephardim. But now that population was added to by the Hungarians. They became the majority of that congregation because there were just so many of them who came. And they had their own unique customs and kashrus. Some were more stringent than the other communities, some were more lenient. And because they were the majority, it seems that the community went along with them. It wasn't a problem implementing their stringencies, because the slaughterhouses, which were owned by the Turks, were very accommodating for the Jews. So if the Jews didn't accept the meat because of the kashrus restrictions and they had very high standards, it would be sold. By the Turks to the Muslims, who didn't have those standards, of course. No loss to the Muslims and no loss to the Jews. Eventually, these Hungarians relocated. They moved to another city. And the present community now wanted to abandon the Hungarian customs, and return back to their original customs. That was one question that they asked. This is to the Maharaj Dam. Another question was, you know, there are questions about, in terms of checking the lungs, in terms of standards. Now, when you on a lung, if there's a lesion, a fatty tissue clinging to it, and again, there's different positions where that fatty tissue may be, it is called a sircha. And in many situations, the sircha deems the animal to be treif, not to be kosher. Now, a food which is meat which is called glatt kosher is meat which, when a sircha is found, when this lesion is found, they fear the worst, that it really represents a blockage of a hole that may be undone, or it could possibly create a hole, is a question of the understanding here, through movement of the animal. It's a problematic sircha, and the animal is deemed to be treif. There is a interpretation, which is accepted by Ashkenazic Jews, that the sircha could be gently removed, and if it can be removed, the fatty tissue can be taken off, the lung blown up, put in water, and if there is no leakage, because you see leakage, if there will be bubbling, you assume that it did not adhere fastly, and it's close to the thing, because it could be removed without, you know, without puncturing the animal, and that is deemed kosher. The difference between glatt kosher and regular kosher is that you go through that procedure, or there's a fear that the procedure is not, may not be done correctly, whatever it is, and you say that any sircha, any animal that has these lesions is just deemed to be not kosher. Of course, glatt kosher has a much higher percentage of things which are deemed treif, non-kosher, than regular kosher. You can go and check it through this procedure, removing the lesion and blowing up the lung. Very often it will start bubbling, you know, but other times it will not. They were asking that by the time, during the interim, and when this question was asked, there was a whole different relationship between the Muslims and the Jews in Sofia. They would not be accommodating the Turks. The Jews were afraid to open up their own slaughterhouses because the percentage of animals were deemed treif, if you can't check, was made the cost of meat exorbitant. So they just couldn't afford it. And they asked if they could relax the laws of this glatt kosher and accept the other opinions. It wasn't their custom. It wasn't even their original custom was, even before the Hungarians came, to declare everything to be treif. But they were asking, besides the Hungarian question, about the Hungarian custom, was this new question, can they relax this in its entirety because of this problem? To this, the Marzdam answered that the Hungarian custom, since it was just imposed upon them, it was not really, they didn't truly accept it, it does not have to be adhered to, but since there still may be problems, he asked the three capable people who are not residents of Sofia, of that community, just transients, should be mater neder, should annul, if it would have the status of a vow, should annul the vow. And in terms of the question of glatt kosher, you know, about blowing up the lungs, he said you should maintain the original custom and disallow the practice of removing the lesion and blowing up the lung. But just interesting how the movements, so just to give you just an example, had an effect. Another effect that it had was on the siddur, on davening. Today, virtually any Jew is not an Ashkenazi, you know, descended from, you know, either he's, you know, if he's an Ashkenazi, he's from Germany or from Eastern Europe, is generally called today a Sephardi, even though it's not technically correct, but it's called a Sephardi. Where they come from, Greece, Morocco, Syria, Israel, they're called Sephardim. The truth is that most of the original Sephardic or Spanish Jews, as the bulk of them, were either converted or died in a difficult journey from Spain. It seems that there were ever remnants of Sephardic or Spanish Jewry settled, they eventually left their mark upon the communities in which they settled, and in a certain sense took them over. This is why even those who are not necessarily descended from Spanish Jews are still called Sephardim. The following tshuva, the Marashdam would get just a better better insight into what happened. And he writes, as on page 13, a certain community's order of prayer, siddur, was arranged in a certain manner according to their ancestral custom. Through the course of time and through migrations in their part of the Golis, the exile experience, this community made its way to the kingdom of Turkey, where traditional customs merged with those of others and where the entire population has assumed the Sephardic mode of prayer. This is because they make up the majority in this kingdom. I guess this is referring to Greece and Turkey proper. I mean, this is not necessarily in the other parts. And their form of prayer is clear and sweet. As a result, all or nearly all of them have forsaken their own customs and follow the Sephardic custom. As it is in the case of the major city of Salonika, where the members of the former communities of Calabria, Provence, Sicily, and Apulia, which is in southern Italy, have assumed the Sephardic custom. As originally they had, each of them had their own particular custom. Only the Ashkenazi community has retained its own distinctive custom. They're asking if it's correct to assume the Sephardic custom. This is a community, they came in, and there's a whole controversy, should they abandon their siddur for what has become now commonplace in Salonika? You know, or should they retain this? And his response, he says, this is a encapsulation. Although it is normally correct and probably mandated to keep one's ancestral custom, in this situation regarding prayer, this is not the case, and he goes on to explain why prayer is different. It is proper to assume the Sephardic mode of prayer, and then I, the humble and inferior, to Shmuel de Medina. One of the great Torah centers during the 16th century was Salonika. This is how contemporary sources describe the city. This is first of the Maharsh Dam. Salonika, the great city unto God, this is taken from a responsum, whose population has a majority of Jews, so it gives you a sense of what the city was, has yeshivas and Torah study that are unparalleled. Without a doubt, it is a mitzvah to leave Skopje, as this is today the capital of Macedonia, and move to Salonika. And there's a question, should he stay put wherever he is or move? And in another tshuva he writes, as far as we know, there is no place within the Golis exile with such a large group of Torah scholars. The holy Torah study groups of Salonika exceed all others in quantity as well as quality. One of Salonika's early Sephardic scholars was of Yaakov ibn Chaviv, the author of the Ein Yaakov, a survivor of the forced conversions of Portugal. He is widely quoted by Rav Yosef Karo in his magnum opus, Beis Yosef. This is just one brief quote. This is just to give you a sense of, this is the ruling of the greats of the generation of Yaakov ibn Chaviv and Rav Levi, his son. All of the sages of Salonika, blessed memory, agree with them. Rav Levi ibn Chaviv went on, left Salonika and went to Yerushalayim, and he will be partially the subject of the next lecture. But the following tshuva is really gives us an insight into life of Salonika during this period. Rav Yaakov, and again, this is taken from the Beis Yosef, this is Rav Yosef Karo's work. Rav Yaakov ibn Chaviv wrote, and he goes on, at present this kingdom, Turkey, does not give us permission to designate a specific house for permanent use as a synagogue. And most certainly we do not have permission to build one. We have to secrete ourselves in basements so our voices may not be heard because of the danger. This is referring, well, he's in specific Salonika. I mean, this was Greece, which was under, at that point, Turkish domain. Oh. It is interesting to note that originally, at the beginning of the Turkish conquest, the Turks were very gracious to the Jews and let them build synagogues. Later on, it would seem that they reinstated the law of Umar, the anti-Jewish legislation instituted by the 8th century Caliph Umar II, which forbade the building of new synagogues and made life difficult for Jews. Another one of the giants of Salonika was Rav Yosef Teitatzik. Writing to a scholar in Turkey who did not recognize him, he writes the following. Even if you, venerable Torah scholar that you are, doesn't know me, why don't you ask the esteemed sage Rav Levi Ibn Chaviv? We lived together for over 25 years. In addition, that exalted sage Rav Yaakov Beirav, which is also the subject of the next lecture, approved of my rulings. A person is allowed to inform others of his scholarship where it would otherwise not be known. This is taken from the Gemara, the Passion of Talmud Nedorim, Psalm of Beis Amud Aleph in 62a. The Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, writes to him, "The light of Israel and its sanctity, the crown of the exile, who stands as a banner amongst the nations, the majestic Rosh Yeshiva of Torah, of our Torah, the venerable and God-fearing sage, after prostrating myself at a distance with a heart that feels close by," and he goes on. But he held Rav Yosef Teitatzik in the highest regard. And in a letter, in a personal letter that he writes, which is quoted by the Chidon, the Shema Gdolim, he writes, "By the life of my spirit, through an entire period of 24 hours, I only spend 6 hours attending to my own bodily needs. The entirety of the remaining 18 hours is devoted to the continual mandated divine service." In other words, he davened, or he studied, for 18 hours a day. In the 6 hours, he ate, he slept. "During those 6 hours, I also take care of matters that come from afar," he answered questions. For in the Sefer Reishis Chochmah, this is one of the early Musar Svarim, those ethical works largely based on the Kabbalah. The author, Rav Elio Dividash, and we'll discuss this in Mitzvah in a future lecture, writes, "I heard that for 40 years that sage, Rav Yosef Teitatzik, a blessed memory, only slept on a regular bed on Friday night. They say it was his custom to sleep on a large chest with his feet dangling, that he would awake at exactly midnight. No one knew of this until after his death, when his wife related it." It's no wonder, because of his tremendous sanctity, that he merited to have an inordinate influence on Jewish life during that time. And he writes, again taken from the responsum that we quoted earlier, this is, "It is more than 40 years in which I am studying one of the most prestigious yeshivas in all of the Turkish Empire. For over the last 15 years, there was no yeshiva throughout the empire that could compare to this one in either wisdom or numbers. Throughout the Romaniyot," this is the Greek-speaking area, "my teachings resound. I have more than 20 close disciples who had their own yeshivas and are halakhic authorities." And referring to Avrom Chassan, writing to Rav Yosef Teitatzik, says, "I have not seen or heard any of the great sages who preceded us in Spain, especially the great master and Rav of Yitzhak de Leon Zatzal, a man who caused this nation to tremble in fright, who were afforded such honors as all of the communities of Israel afford to you." It seems that Rav Yosef Teitatzik, those following in the Spanish tradition, was not only a tremendous tzaddik and a tremendous godel batorah, a tremendous sage in Torah wisdom, but he was also a scientist. And we know of a manuscript which was written in the year 1499, written evidently by a student of his, describing the use of the astrolabe, which was an astronomical instrument. "This concludes the explanatory treatise on the workings of the astrolabe, based on the teachings of Rav Yosef Teitatzik." Through the years, Turkey became a haven not only for the original Spanish exiles, but also for Bali Tshuva, Anusim, forced converts or their descendants who joined their fellow Jews and returned back to Judaism. In the next lecture, we are going to describe life in Egypt. And see the impact of the Spanish expulsion on this ancient community. Now, are there any questions? Yes.
I don't remember the exact name.
We don't have to take credit for everybody. You know. He came from Jewish descent, but he was not Jewish. His father's mother was Jewish, but he was not a Jew. But that's a story of in itself.
What tribe did the Turks originally from?
Yeah, the Turks were a generic people, the Turkic people. It was just the Ottoman Turks were this clan, you know, this fellow, this is Ertogrul, you know, came, and he had this fan of his, you know, of his people. And they expanded and conquered everybody else. But the people who live in, you know, that whole area here of Samarkand, I mean, is it, you know, in Crimea, I mean, it's all Turkic people. So there's like it's a generic, you know. There was a group of Turks before that had an empire, the Seljuk Turks. It was really because of their conquest that the Crusades began. So this is just another group of Turks. Yeah.
All these Turkish tribes were Muslim.
Yeah. At that time, they were all Muslim. It's interesting. Even the Mongols at that point were Muslims. You know, within this juncture of history, they had conquered the Arabs, but the Arabs conquered them, and they became Mongols. This Tamerlane, you know, who was responsible, he says, who killed one of the Turkish sultans here. You know, there's Bayazid. He was a Muslim, and he had his cousins, the Golden Horde. In other words, these were these Mongols who controlled Russia at the time, and then the 1300s. There were also Muslims. And so you have all those people in Samarkand, Uzbekistan. You know, they were all descendants of these people.
So the Muslim tribes were fighting each other?
Yeah.
They go back a lot.
Yeah. They're peaceful people, you know. Yeah.
The religion is peace, the people are.
Yeah.
The Shita that's in Sofia. So the Muslims were eating the kosher.
Yeah, that's halal. That's also they you know, it is accepted. Maybe Muslim pride, you know, they don't want a Jewish shechita. But I know of someone who had who was the rabbinic supervisor of a slaughterhouse here that supplied, you know, meat to Saudi Arabia. You know, so it is accepted. So you bring up a very good question. There's a problem of the Karaite community of intermarrying with the Jews, because there's a problem of their divorce documents are not recognized. So they have a marriage and then they have a divorce. The woman is really, by Jewish law, still not allowed to get married. And then if they remarry, then there's a problem of their children. We'll all discuss this in the next lecture. Yeah, but that's a topic of the next lecture. Right?
I have a question regarding the time frame. We started out discussing the Ottoman Empire, and then further on down, like on page 11, you're talking about the Turkish Empire.
The Ottomans were a Turkish clan. You know, this is kind of this Othman. And they were Turks. And the empire they created is the Turkish Empire. And then, which is, they call the Ottoman Empire because of the name of the founder of this group of people. And there's all of these kings, these sultans, until the very last sultan, you know, who was forced from his throne, you know, at the end of World War I. They were all descendants of this Ottoman. So that's why it's called Ottoman Empire, but they're Turks. It started, you know, by bits and pieces. We get in the beginning of the lecture, it started at the end of the 1200s. It started growing, and they took a little bit here and a little bit more and more and more, you know. And in 1453, they had already conquered Constantinople, so they had really taken over the Byzantine Empire. And then they moved over to take over Serbia and Bulgaria. So there was Suleiman was threatening Vienna. He laid siege to Vienna. I mean, he was not successful, but he laid siege to Vienna. And they were the Turks were really a problem, you know, for Europe for a very long time. You know, the very last time the Turks, you know, were this major threat was in 1683. That they again laid siege to Vienna, and the siege was lifted by the Polish king Jan Sobieski. You know, there's a term in Yiddish, says from Melch Sobieski's Yaron. You know, from King Sobieski. Jan Sobieski was the Polish king, so he helped lift this siege in 1683 of Vienna. That was really the last time. That was the beginning of the final of the year, the decline, the real decline of the Turks. That day, by the way, was September 11th. And 318, you know, years to the day, they tried again.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.